This podcast was brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on Sirius XM.
Welcome to our Behind the Markets podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz. Alongside Wharton Frank Professor Jeremy Siegel, we tackle the latest market trends every week on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 132. Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at WisdomTree. I'm joined by my co-host, Jeremy Siegel, is also a senior economist for WisdomTree. I should note our discussion is not tied to the offers of any investment products, and I'm a registered representative of Foreside Fund Services. We're going to have a very interesting show. I'm on Wharton's campus in the studio. We have a special guest, Aaron Dubin, who's a VP and head of business strategy there for Team 8. He's live on campus. Aaron, thank you for coming to Wharton. Thanks for being here on campus.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
We're going to get into a lot of what Team 8 does and some of their views on the economy, the markets, the position that they look at. But Professor Siegel, it's been an interesting week. The hot inflation data, cool inflation data, but rates are moving. Curious to get your read on all the latest data.
Yeah. Okay, so I think two things are really dominating this week. Certainly an inflation panic, I think way overdone, hopefully cooled by some of the more recent data. I'll talk about that in a second. Secondly, at least now of this recording, a potential attack by Iran on Israel or any other site. I mean, that is really driving the markets today, I think. I mean, we see Brent oil over 91. We see a bid in the Treasury market, even though the inflation expectation news, at least on the University of Michigan, did not come out very well today. So again, that definitely can move markets over the weekend or early next week if such an attack happens. Let's talk about the CPI. I thought a way overreaction. If the data was a few hundredths of 1% less, it would have rounded exactly to expectations, but it wasn't. So it rounded a tenth higher than expectations. But the most notable thing about it was that over half of the increase, and this is right from the BLS, of the core rate of inflation over the last year comes from shelter and from auto insurance or insurance in general, but specifically auto insurance. Now, we've talked about the shelter part of the CPI for a long period of time. It did cool off to a 0.4% month over month increase, but the year over year is still almost 5%. Which is double or more of any of the on-the-ground indicators. So it is still giving too high an indicator there. As far as auto insurance is concerned, data has shown that auto insurance rates follow auto prices by 12 to 15 months later with that lag. Well, we all know how much auto prices went up during the pandemic. Used and new cars were up 20-25%, and rates stayed relatively the same. And then they suddenly go up because parts are more expensive and other factors come into play. But the important thing is that forward-looking is that the auto prices, used and new, have not shown any increase over the last year. And that means that important component is stabilizing into the future. So when you look forward-looking, it does not look anywhere near as dismal as the backward-looking data that you had because of the lag in terms of the realization of those prices. Now, PPI, you know, the next day kind of calmed expectations a little bit, came in pretty much at, or maybe even a tiny bit below expectations. With the PPI data, I saw a 1 or 2 basis points lowering of the PCE expectations that we're going to get for For the month of March, at the end of this month. Import prices also were that got reported on Friday were also very much in line. Anything disturbing again? Inflation expectations, 1 in 5 and 10-year expectations jumped up. We've seen that jump up and down 0.2% over the last 6 months. It was on the upside today, probably because of what's going on with gasoline prices and probably also with all the talk about what's happening with the CPI. I wouldn't put too much stock on that as far as that looking ahead. As far as the real data is concerned, we had the jobless claims go down to 210,000. Again, you know, it's, again, a very stable number. You know, we've talked about the 200 to 240 range as being very stable. No real indicators have deteriorated. Of course, we're going to get retail sales early next week. We'll take a look at what's going on in March. That'll be an important indicator looking forward. But again, we see no real deterioration on the real side. And what about the on the ground inflation indicator? We talked about a big rise in commodity prices, the Bloomberg Commodity Price Index last week. It's somewhat stabilized this week. It's hard because of what's going on of in oil and the Mideast situation to try to separate out how much of those commodity prices are being affected by a potential escalation of the conflict over there. We also saw, and I'm seeing a tremendous increase in bank deposits for the first time since the clampdown on interest rates in 2022. We really have had an increase in deposits. This is a good sign, I think. I think it's a sign of strength in the economy and a resumption of liquidity growth, what I think could support growth going forward. GDP estimates for the first quarter are remaining in the low twos. No change really there. What is interesting in the market, certainly, long-term bond rates went up because of what's going on in the CPI and the expectation of fewer increases. Today, we got a bid on bonds because of what's going on in the Mideast. What is interesting is despite the rise in interest rates, there's been a relative movement to the growth stocks. Growth stocks last year were hurt by higher interest rates. Value stocks seem to do better in those situations. I think that situation is reversed because higher interest rates are thought to certainly affect the financial, the banking system, the real estate prices, and the banks that finance those, small businesses that borrow at prime plus and all that. And so we have a flip of what had been the way you think about inflation and interest rates and value versus growth. At least in the last couple of weeks, we actually had a big resumption of a growth surge as interest rates went up following the CPI announcement. It's hard to say what's going to happen later on. Of course, I think that, again, some of these fears are overblown. We're going to have, before the June announcement, we're going to have two more CPI reports. The CPI for April and actually the CPI for May is actually coming out during the meeting itself. Chairman Powell will probably know the data by the time he meets with the FOMC. A lot of things can change. This idea that this seals no decrease in June, I think is wrong. I'm not saying there will be a decrease in June. I'm just saying that we got two more CPIs and people put, often too much emphasis on the most recent data that we had. The most important thing is that the economy remains strong. We don't see a deterioration in the real indicators. Earnings are just beginning to come out with the banks. Banks have run up, the big banks, now not the small banks. The big banks, have run up a lot recently. So even though we had some big beats on Friday We had some of those prices went down, but they had rallied 20, 30, 40% over the last 3 or 4 months. So I expectations were high. We are beating by a high in the very early data. We'll get a lot more next week, of course. We do have some good beats for quarter one. And I expect overall quarter one certainly to come ahead of what current expectations are.
A lot of big comments there, the professor, to kick us off. You know, it's interesting on that value growth, small caps. We talked about, hey, the better they don't cut, you're going to have a better economy, buy things priced for recession that were small caps, but they seem primed for that interest rate story. They
yeah, didn't. I mean, it's quite interesting. There's just an idea that the small firms are financing at prime plus. And of course, you got to take out the banking situation, commercial real estate situation, not getting any better. That's a simmering situation. I don't think it's going to cause any crisis. You know, the big banks have it under, the handle on it. But for the small banks, they really don't. They're going to be owning a lot of real estate. There's going to be a lot of churn and change and consolidation in that area. And then everyone that gets financed from small banks are going to be affected by what kind of rates they attend. And I think that pall is over the entire small cap area keeping their prices at, you know, what certainly look like bargain prices from a long-term standpoint.
Aaron, you're going to talk us about what's happening in the cyber and AI space, but any macro questions or comments you want to get from the professor before we say goodbye to him?
Nope.
All good. Okay, so professor, well, it's been a big week for inflation and the markets with interest rates, but thank you for kicking us off to start the show.
Absolutely. We'll talk about some of the real data coming in on next week's program.
Thank you so much for kicking us off. So I'm going to turn the conversation over to Aaron Dubin, who's VP of Strategy at Teammate. And they're one of WisdomTree's partners on a WisdomTree Teammate Cybersecurity Index. They are deep experts on all things tech, fintech, sort of venture capitalists, but with a very unique background. Aaron, I think one of the places to start our conversation is really, you know, the AI moment and what AI means for technology, how you guys are thinking about what is. We had Dan Ives on our show. He thinks in 1995 for where we are in the AI cycle. How do you look at AI as an opportunity, things that you're investing around, what it means for your space?
Great. Perfect place to start. Very timely. we spend a lot of time thinking about AI. As it impacts our world, which is the world of cybersecurity, data, fintech, and healthcare. And so we're always looking at the opportunities to apply those developments in AI, those things like GPT, you know, 4, GPT-5, to our world. The place that I've been spending the most time thinking about this topic is the intersection of cybersecurity and AI. And you can kind of look at this from two angles, right? So one angle is cyber for AI, and the other angle is AI for cyber, right? And so AI for cyber usually breaks down into either using AI for cyber defense or using AI for cyber offense. And we don't deal with offense, obviously. We build companies to protect the world, to protect cyber defenders at, you know, big companies. And the way that they're using AI is basically to help them automate their workflows in cyber, mainly the incident response teams that do a lot of investigations after a cyber breach or what we call threat hunting. So they're looking for, you know, vulnerabilities and threats. But it's really scary to think about the way that hackers and attackers are using AI against us. So you can think of that as just massive automation of attacks. So think about, you know, we're already struggling today to defend our organizations against the pace of cyber attacks. But imagine if you can get 1,000 attacks, right, in 1 second because it was all an automated AI attack. Or to take it one step further, with generative AI, you can actually ask those Gen AI systems to write you malicious code, to write a cybersecurity phishing email to automate 1,000 phishing emails that all look like they were real because the AI wrote each one individually, right? So there's this sort of thinking about AI for cyber on the offense and defensive side. I've been spending most of my time on the other side of this, which is thinking about how we protect our AI systems from attackers, right? So if AI really is, you know, you said 1995, right? Then think about where cybersecurity was in 1995 for the internet. And the answer is there really was none yet, right? Or it was the very, very, very early days. And so that's what we're seeing in AI right now. But it's scary, the like seriousness of the systems that are, you know, going live or in production, let's say, that are using AI, or that AI is actually a majority of the backbone of those systems.
Well, I've never tried to write malicious software code, but could I ask ChatGPT to write me a code that will go infect somebody's computer?
So you could, actually.
And it'll respond?
Initially. Today, obviously, people are more aware of those types of threats. And one of the first things that companies that pay for ChatGPT or governments actually are asking for are what we call guardrails for ChatGPT. So basically like rules, right, and boundaries of what people can do or say or ask it to do. You know, for instance, one of the things that, you know, we showed in one of our demos was, you know, people were asking ChatGPT, you know, how can I get away with murder, right? And it would give you this whole like, you know, step-by-step guide. You can't really ask those things anymore. You can't ask it to write you, you know, a phishing email or malicious code, but there are these things called jailbreaks, which are little like loopholes or vulnerabilities in those guardrails that hackers continue to discover. And so there are still ways around those guardrails. And that's just in the sense of ChatGPT itself. But imagine when, so ChatGPT is just one form of AI. There's a lot of, let's say, homegrown AI that companies are creating themselves in-house. And they're being used to run their loan right systems online, or their manufacturing facilities, or transportation. I like to think of autonomous vehicles, right? Or healthcare, which is the scary, maybe one of the scariest examples, right? Think about AI in medical systems, medical imaging systems, making automated decisions about, you know, your X-ray or your CT scan. But imagine how those can be attacked or manipulated. I don't want to think about, you know, my Tesla, somebody kind of tweaking, right, the algorithm in a way to trick my car into driving itself right off the bridge. Or we saw this research come out about how they took medical CT scans of cancer, and they tricked those, you know, those doctors into seeing the CT scan that had cancer looked like it didn't, there was no cancer. And the one that didn't have cancer, they actually kind of generated a cancer-like, you know, image onto that. So there are all of these kind of scary ways. Now, listen, we're not really seeing these attacks in the wild yet. And that's kind of our sweet spot, right, at Team 8, where, so and we'll get into what we do, but we like to get into these industries at the beginning. And to kind of form our view and even start building our companies, you know, before those things explode. And so it's a perfect timing. I'm glad to say we're not seeing those attacks yet. Hopefully we'll have more security when we do start to see those attacks, but it's coming.
When I talk about you talk about building companies. How, talk a little bit about your model in terms of what it is that Team 8 does in terms of both as a venture capitalist, but also a company builder.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to share about this model. So we are a venture group, a global venture group with about $1 billion in assets under management, but we're not your typical venture group. And we were one of the early pioneers of this model that we call Foundry model or Startup Studio. So essentially, it's a VC fund that builds their own companies in-house and then spins them out. And so the way that that model works is we have a bunch of experts that work in Team 8 in our various domains. So we focus on cyber, data, fintech, and digital health. And we build these communities of corporate customers, right? So one of our communities is what we call our CISO village, our Chief Information Security Village. We use the word village because, you know, we joke it takes a village to build a company. And so we have a village of 350 CISOs from mainly Fortune 500 and Global 2000 companies. We get them together all the time, and we just ask them to complain to us and share their problems, right? And what are their biggest pain points, and what can we do about them in the form of building companies, basically, to solve those problems? And so we gather all of these ideas and problems. When we research them, we validate them, and when we find what we think is a really big, meaningful problem, we'll go and we'll search for the best founders in the world from that domain that we would want to partner with to build that company and solve that problem. And so we have our problem, we have our team, we match them together. We invest between $5 and $10 million typically in that company through their pre-seed and their seed round. And then we basically give them our team, and we have a team of what we call 80 company builders, which are specialists in every category that a company would need in their first year of operation: business development, marketing, HR, finance, back office, and then, of course, my team, strategy. And basically, we help those companies grow as quickly as possible and kind of de-risk.
Well, talking about the team, you know, and sort of the intersection of AI and what's going on in the world today. So if AI is the top story, geopolitics is the second top story. But there's an intersection between AI and geopolitics. We were talking about an Economist story out just this week. Team 8 comes from, you can talk about the origin story of Team 8, but you have a lot of team members in Israel. You've got Israel under attack. The stories, headlines today are Iran is preparing to attack Israel, or Israel is being prepared for an attack. We'll see if that attack comes together. But Israel is at the leadership of trying to use AI to identify targets. There's a story saying they've identified 37,000 targets is what the Economist article will talk about. But talk about how this war is impacting Team 8 in Israel.
Yeah, so a lot to talk about there for sure. But I should start by saying I work with a lot smarter people on this topic than myself.
You're in the U.S. You're here in...
Yeah, we have 70 people at our headquarters in Tel Aviv. Going back to the origin story of Team 8. So Team 8 was actually founded by a guy named Nadav Tzafrir, the former commander of the Israeli NSA, which is basically an elite military technology intelligence and computer hacking unit. And when he started Team 8 after retiring from the military, he brought all of his best hackers and attackers with him. And that was sort of the first team building the first 10 cyber companies that we created. And so there's obviously that perspective. We also work very closely with a guy named Admiral Mike Rogers, who is the former U.S. NSA chief. And so together, we have a pretty good perspective, I think, on Israel and on the U.S. And, from where I sit, obviously, AI is something that the military is using, right? I'm reading about in the news, right? It's been publicly stated in articles. But this didn't start just from the recent conflict, right? One of the best examples of it I like to use is the Iron Dome. So the Iron Dome is Israel's short-range missile defense system. It basically intercepts enemy rockets that are coming into Israel by targeting like the exact point where that rocket is going to peak over an area where no people are, where, it can actually automatically understand if they don't intercept that target, it's not going to cause any damage, they're actually not even going to intercept that target because it costs about $100,000 for every rocket interception. And there have been tens of thousands of rockets. So that was sort of the first, I think, big example of at least what we hear about from the Israeli military using AI. Some of these more recent examples, I'm not as knowledgeable about, but, it totally makes sense that one of the most advanced militaries in the world is going to leverage, right, the latest and greatest in AI to identify terrorists. And I think that's what's happening. Now, where this kind of comes back to what I was talking about in Cyber for AI, essentially, or more broadly speaking, what we call trustworthy AI. So cyber is just one part of how we trust AI, but there's a lot of things that we need to check in those AI systems to be able to trust them. So things like explainability, can we explain why it's behaving the way that it is, or what we call bias. So was that AI trained on data that had hidden biases in it that caused it to behave in a way that's biased? But one of the things that I would, you know, be interested in is, you know, making sure that there's a way to sort of check and test, right, that the decisions that the AI makes or the targets that they identify have some kind of human, right, in the loop, or trustworthiness mechanism.
And at a cultural level, at a personal level, how have you guys been impacted? How are you guys operating in light of this ongoing conflict?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously it was really, really tough times when this all started at Team 8. We have, so in Israel, right, there's mandatory service. So one of, I think, the few places where almost everybody in the country is like a reservist. So most of them can be called back at any time. And this was a case, I think, where Israel had like 300,000 reservists at one point that were called up. And so, you know, a bunch of people from my team, from my company, were in Army reserve duty. I still remember, funny story, we were having a call on AI with Gartner, which is, you know, one of the big research experts, and with their lead AI analyst. And one of my teammates, who is the former head of like the AI lab in the Israeli military, you know, jumped onto the Zoom from like an Army base, right, with his full uniform on. And it was like a coffee break that he had. And the Gartner analyst was kind of applauding him and saying, you know, that's real commitment right there, that you're going to kind of jump off your break from, you know, in the middle of this conflict to chat with us about AI. So we had a lot of reservists that were called up from Team 8, both combat and technology. And then, of course, everybody was in some way, shape, or form impacted by, you know, that day. So, you know, it's in Israel, there are less degrees of separation, right? They say like it's 1 or 2 degrees of separation there. Everybody knows everybody. So everybody knew somebody that was impacted by that attack, whether they were killed at the rave, whether they were kidnapped and being held hostage in Gaza, or whether they were just soldiers that were sent out, right, to defend Israel and ended up getting kind of killed in conflict. So it's been really tough times. I would say now most of our reservists are back. But you know, this is an evolving situation, right?
News present today. So yeah, we'll see what happens over the weekend.
Exactly. So who knows with, you know, the Iran situation, with the other, I think, big concern is if, you know, Israel has multiple fronts, right? And we've been talking about Gaza mostly, but, you know, there's the North, Hezbollah, who, you know, has kind of been waiting on the sidelines, and that's another risk.
Yeah, so we'll try to get to better topics here than this heartbreaking one. But for geopolitics, so Russia, Ukraine is the other big ongoing one, and there's a lot of cyber issues dealing with them, right? Do you see, is that something at the forefront of top of mind for your conversations with where geopolitics is impacting your investment decisions, how you're thinking about what are the opportunities to be on the attacker's perspective? As you said, you guys came from an attacker's perspective.
Yeah. So this attacker's perspective is something that we created at Team 8, where, you know, a lot of our cyber experts are former attackers. And so we always try to put the attacker hat on when we're thinking about building a new company and kind of how are the attackers going to be 5 steps ahead of the defenders, and how can we bake that into kind of our solutions? And so, yeah, we've spent quite a bit of time thinking about that. Obviously, at the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, there was an expectation that there would be a lot more cyber. I think, attacks used by Russia, let's say, than there actually were. Hmm. I think that one of the things that, you know, was less expected, but is still pretty happening pretty frequently today is this idea of like hacktivism, where you have basically as a way to express your views, right? You have individuals or kind of rogue groups of either self-taught hackers or kind of former professional hackers that are targeting companies or countries as a way to kind of get involved, right? And be active in this situation. And so I think these global geopolitical events like Russia, Ukraine, like US, China, US, Iran, Iran, Israel, I mean, the list goes on, are have been kind of prompting those groups to get in the game. And we're starting, I mean, that's scary in and of itself because, you know, it's one thing for, I guess, a nation state, they have much more firepower, but, you know, they all are also a little bit more predictable in those cases than those rogue groups.
Well, we're here on Wharton's campus. I wonder if you're going to motivate a whole new set of hacktivists. You know, you get a lot of activism on these college campuses. We'll see if you get the M&T students here. They're sort of the elite of the elite here at Penn. See if they get a bunch of hacktivists who are going to sign up to a cause.
I hope not.
It'll be interesting. Aaron, there's a bunch of different headlines. You know, AI is in the news all over. A lot of people talk about the U.S. leadership in AI and technology generally. What do you see? You know, some people say in Europe they can't get out of their own regulation way. Like, we're an innovator here. China's a copier and Europe's a regulator. But like, what is your view on what's happening in Europe?
Yeah, so I like the way that you put that.
It's a meme I stole from Twitter.
I might have to steal that myself. But I think it's actually very on point in terms of the AI regulation situation that we're seeing right now. Obviously, all of these big and powerful AI systems have been released in the last year or so with little to no regulation. Or even things like we said, security, guardrails, and stuff like that. And so that's scary to a lot of countries, especially when you think about how people would use it for evil and not, right, not for good, but for evil. And I think like we saw with data protection and privacy, which, you know, Europe passed this sort of landmark regulation in 2018 called the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, which started fining companies that misused, right, or abused customers' private information. We're seeing that repeat again now with AI. And so the biggest headline is that the EU just passed the AI Act, which is the first and most comprehensive AI regulation in the world. And my personal view is that this is going to be bigger than the GDPR. So in GDPR, a company that violated right, data privacy was fined 4% of their global annual turnover. With the AI Act, it's 7%. And this applies to basically like any person in the AI value chain that's selling something to an AI system to Europe or has an AI system that's being used in Europe or by European citizens. So, I mean, this is super, super broad in scope. Now, they came out with this act. The U.S. came out with President Biden's executive order on AI came out at the end of October. As you know, there's a big difference between an executive order and kind of a government regulation like we saw out of Europe. But I think it's good. We're going in the right direction in the U.S. And that sort of executive order helped to get people talking and thinking, get a lot of those different government organizations working on this. I don't think we're ever going to see a federal AI regulation in the US. I think my opinion is it's going to play out like the GDPR played out, which we still don't have a GDPR in the US. We have our form of it, which is called CCPA, which started in California, which is a consumer, a data privacy regulation. And I think now we have five states that have their own version of that. But I think that's how AI regulation is going to play out in the U.S. as well, which is going to be a state-by-state thing. And maybe one day, if all 50 states have, you know, more or less the same type of regulation, it will become a federal thing. But we're a long way away from that.
That could either be a positive or a negative when you come to, you know, is it better to just have one unified system and set of rules, or you're going to have all sorts of these sub-themes? That's sort of an interesting contrast versus Europe versus the U.S. In AI conversations, that generate a lot of buzz, open AI, you know, open source, and Elon funded it to be open source, then he now calls it the biggest closed source AI. But AI, or open source, has been top of mind in the cyber headlines, right? There's been a Linux story. Tell listeners, for people, what happened with the Linux breach? What happened there for cyber perspective? What it means for you guys?
Yeah, so it came out, I guess, in the news, 2 weeks ago, that a Microsoft software developer kind of noticed something funny happening on his own computer and discovered a backdoor, right, which is basically like a way into the system, that one of the contributors of a popular open source project called XZUtils, which is a kind of a data compression utility for Linux computer applications. So this contributor to this big open source project basically played a long con of like several years, where he ingratiated himself to this community of developers, became one of the lead contributors to this project, and, you know, one day managed to kind of slip some malicious code into that project, which in a way was a door into any system that was running, you know, that using that utility, essentially. And so it was really planned out. It was really
multi-year process,
premeditated, methodical. This Microsoft developer just kind of stumbled upon it. And thank goodness he did, because he basically averted what could have been, you know, a SolarWinds type event, or Log4j. You know, there are these really big examples that have happened in the last few years where hackers aren't targeting like the end system, they're targeting the distribution channel that will get you to, you know, thousands or millions of systems. What we call it in our industry a software supply chain attack. So, you know, supply chain obviously has been in the news quite a bit lately,
the physical
supply chain, trucking and, you know, shortages at the bridges and everything. We have a similar supply chain in software, right? Where software is never like there's never a unique code base, right, for any new piece of software that's built. It's always iterated and iterated on existing code bases. And so, you know, when you're using all of these different third-party libraries and tools, and you're building your app on top of a lot of that existing code, you never really know what's in there, right? And so we have ways where we're actually tracking all of the different components that go into, right, the software that we're building. And you have to sort of check each one by one. And you don't have to just do it once. You have to do it every time there's a change to any of the software, right? And so it's a really complicated process, and it gets more and more complicated as you use more and more third-party stuff. This is actually one of the themes that we're tracking in the Teammate WisdomTree Cyber Index, you know, that we're working with WisdomTree on. So we have 8 cybersecurity themes in the index that we track that we think are driving the future growth in the cybersecurity industry. Those themes change, right? So we're constantly monitoring those themes and evolving them to, you know, the current events. But one of the themes is called shift left. And shift left is this term in the industry, you know, that's meant to kind of push developers to work more closely with cybersecurity professionals. And so, believe it or not, today, a lot of cyber engineers, right, the security professionals, are not even talking to the developers. And the developers are being measured on how quickly they can write code and how quickly they can deploy applications. Not even really, you know,
are they protecting it?
Yeah, being concerned about the security of it, right? There's sort of a handoff of like, hey, I built this thing, I'm ready, it's ready to go. You secure it now. But the more closely we can get those two teams to work together, the more secure everything is going to be by design, right, from the beginning. And so that's just one kind of recent events example of, you know, one of our real life cyber themes in practice.
Well, we're all operating in the cloud, sort of cloud computing. And I think about my own protection of passwords and how I protect it. You know,
yeah.
Use things like Dashlane or one, what's the other one?
Like the password managers. Yeah.
So is that creating more risk? Is it more secure? You're always forgetting passwords. I become a user of some of those services. But yeah. They say, like, well, no, if they hack this one place, they have access to everything I have.
Yeah. So, you know, you're hitting on all of the key topics here. I can connect most of them to specific cyber themes, actually, that we track in our index. But cloud security is probably the biggest and most popular one. You know, it has been happening, but it was definitely accelerated a little bit by COVID and by the remote kind of work from home trend. Actually, both cloud and identity, which is password stuff that you mentioned. And so today what we're seeing is like everybody who wasn't already on the cloud is moving to the cloud or to SaaS, right? Software as a service, which is just, you know, instead of, I guess, installing software right on premise on your computer, you're just like logging into a website and using the application over the web. All of those systems need to be secured. And the funny part or ironic part about it is that I think I saw this statistic, 99% of like cloud breaches are due to misconfigurations. So it's not even an attacker that's like targeting your system necessarily or breaking in through a vulnerability. It's the way you set it up, right? You misconfigured it. You forgot to turn on one of those, you know, kind of controls. And that's what is the issue right now with cloud security.
Human error. That's why we need AI to run everything.
Human error. 74% of cyber breaches, I think, in 2023, according to Verizon's data breach report, had some element of human error.
I've done the wrong thing. I did it once, and I remembered the one time I clicked on something, and then I get a call from Schwab. Hey, Mr. Schwartz, are you authorizing this transfer of a six-figure number? No, I'm not.
Oh, my goodness. Good catch.
Like, oh, I think they must have had access to my computer.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's all so we saw this happening so frequently. So before we actually had seven themes, not eight themes. We always wanted eight themes because we're Team 8. But we realized that this human error theme deserved to be a theme on its own. And so we actually last year launched a new theme to the index, which we call Layer 8, which is like there are seven layers of the kind of networking model. And the eighth layer we're calling the human layer, which is like the people that sit above the systems. And so Layer 8 deals with human security. Basically, that no matter what security controls that you have in place, humans are always going to find a way to beat them or to break them.
And we're always going to click on the stupid stuff that we're
always going to click
on
the phishing links. And so, yeah, if you're absolutely right, cloud, you know, kind of the human layer, identity, right? Passwords, I think, yes, password managers are a single point of failure. But the more that we can just completely eliminate passwords altogether, the better. And I think that...
Is that biometric? Like the face ID is...
So yeah, it's biometrics or, you know, kind of the... So what we like to say when on the topic of identity is there's kind of this new trend. It's not new anymore, but for the general public, it's called zero trust, which is basically trust nobody, authenticate everybody. All the time. And so instead of just like one password or one, you know, ID card swipe and you're in, right? You have the keys to the kingdom. There's this sort of constant authentication happening, whether it's biometric or, you know, multi-factor or whatever throughout the day and based on your behavior. And so if we assume that everybody is a malicious actor, then, you know, we can kind of raise that the bar, right, for defense.
You know, I do see the credit card companies getting pretty good. The last few times I've had fraudulent charges, I didn't discover it. The credit card company texted me, is this fraudulent activity? It's like, yes, this is fraudulent activity.
Yep. a lot of the times it's that anomaly detection algorithms that are running in the background. And by the way, that also, those anomaly detection algorithms, it's a similar way to identify insider attackers too, which is a whole nother thing which we didn't talk about. But sometimes, you know, the hackers are, you know, our colleagues, right, that work with us have, you know, full admin access, right, to all of our systems. And so there's another element there, yeah.
It's like the open source person working on you for 3 years. I mean, people worry about that now in the U.S. Is there people here who are going to do that?
A lot of times there are nation states, you know, that are kind of finding those people, paying them handsomely. There's a lot of incentive there, right? And one of the things which we won't get into now, but, you know, there's a possibility that those sorts of things could increase in hard economic times. Because when people really need that next paycheck, they may be more, you know, more likely to give in.
Interesting. Very interesting. There's a few other big stories in the headlines. You can tell me which one is most interesting. You've got the AT&T data breach and the loanDepot attack are two things you flagged for me. Which one is the most interesting?
I mean, I'll mention briefly on the loanDepot attack because it connects to, I think, the other really big theme that we're tracking, which is ransomware. So from what I read in the news, loanDepot was hit with a ransomware attack. I think they didn't disclose if they paid the ransom or not, right? We don't know.
Should you? Do you suggest
we don't know what happened? I think that it's against the law to pay the ransom, technically.
Now they ask you to be paid in Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think I saw this really interesting statistic from that data breach report that said that the cost of a ransomware attack goes up if you don't involve law enforcement. So law enforcement actually helps bring the cost of that ransomware attack down. I think it was $500,000 it goes up in cost. We at Team8, you know, we have this community of CISOs that we meet on a regular basis. And one of the things we like to do is we like to bring one of our ransomware negotiators. So we actually have one of the companies Team8 built was called Signia. They were an incident response like a services company that basically went out to banks and to law firms that were breached and figured out everything that went wrong and, you know, how to prevent that from happening in the future. They're all ex-Israeli, you know, army hackers. And one of the people they have on staff is a ransomware negotiator, which is like an FBI hostage negotiator, yeah, but for ransomware. And he puts on this awesome session where they talk about all of the little negotiation tactics, which turn out to be a lot of the time Russian ransomware groups, right? And so
hacktivists.
Yeah, we're hacktivists. But let's say these Russian ransomware groups, we don't have time to get into it now, but they're run like modern, global organizations. They have HR teams. They have like monthly business targets, right? The quotas.
So are they private business or is it part of the state?
So,
or both?
You know, it's probably a little bit of both. What, you know, I say is most of the time they're like state blessed, maybe not right, necessarily state sponsored, but those states are letting them do their thing, essentially. And so what I was going to say about the ransomware is like, so they lock your systems up, right? And they say, you know, pay me in Bitcoin and I'll give you the decryption key and you can unlock your systems. If you pay the ransomware, they will connect you with their help desk, their tech help desk to help you unlock your systems.
But like, what if you pay? Do they ever not do that?
Lot of them actually care a lot about their reputation.
Because they want to have their reputation.
It's a business. It's a long-term business, right? So if you don't...
We got you, but you're going to be unlocked if you pay.
Correct. If they don't unlock you, then they're not. No one's going to believe them the next time, right?
You got to pay.
Yeah, you got to pay.
We've talked about a lot of different, very topical conversations. We talked a lot about your themes for building this index. We didn't talk about why you wanted to build an index as a venture capitalist firm, but let's go to sort of the big question. We only have 2 minutes left. As you all think, you know, tech has been, I talked about 95 where you are. Some people say, are you in a bubble? Are these things expensive? Certainly no area has been hotter than AI, and cyber was one of the hottest performers last year. How do you all think about investing in the space, both private markets, the unicorns that are out there? Give me 2 minutes of final closing thoughts about the opportunity for people from here, from where you are priced in the markets today.
So, you know, it's been a ride. 2021 was an epic year, I think, in most markets, but particularly in tech, right, in venture capital and in cyber. Things are coming down quite a bit from where we were at the peak. What this means for us, I think for our business, is that, you know, valuations, you know, sort of have to come down, or the companies that have that raised money at super high valuations that maybe weren't able to justify all of those numbers could be seeing a lot of down rounds, right? So they're raising at sort of lower valuations than the last valuation that they had. That's not never good in our business. Teammate has always tried to kind of go straight and steady through those moments of ups and downs, where we don't like to get too into the hype when it comes to like valuations into our companies. We want to build real, solid, sustainable companies that you know, at the kind of when you're out through the other side of those moments in the market, you're still super strong and robust, right? Your value is based strongly on the fundamentals of the business. And so I think that hasn't changed for us. But having said that, going forward, you know, there's an opportunity. A lot of times they say the best companies are built, right, in those toughest times. And so we're really on the hunt for those strong kind of fundamental driven companies.
Well, it's been fascinating. I've loved getting to know Aaron and his team at Teammate. It's a very interesting model where they do, you can get private access, private side of the business with them, but also now we partner together on the public side, investing in an ETF. So look for Teammate. You can find Teammate on Twitter. You can reach out to Aaron on LinkedIn. I'm Jeremy Schwartz. You can listen to us on our Behind the Markets podcast every week. Aaron, thank you for coming to Wharton and having this great conversation with us here in studio.
Thanks so much. Great to be back in my hometown.
Very good. Well, Dion, thanks for being the day with me here in the studio. We'll see you all next week.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Markets podcast. If you want to learn more about WisdomTree, visit wisdomtree.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeremy D. Schwartz. I'd like to thank Patty Hall for producing our live program on SiriusXM, Channel 132, and our podcast producer, Daniel Bruno. Join us next week for another edition of the show.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.